From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Amandine Lee.
This week on War News Radio, pop culture. First, we hear about Afghans' love for Bollywood cinema.
Next, we talk to soldiers who share videos of their experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan on YouTube.
Then, we visit an art exhibit about the war in Afghanistan.
Finally, we hear from opponents of the military's controversial Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
This is War News Radio. Bollywood films are immensely popular in Afghanistan. Many Afghans speak Indian languages and identify with Indian culture as portrayed in the movies. Karim Saryamed has the story in this piece, first aired in September.
If you mention Afghan cinema to a movie buff, there's a good chance that they'll want to talk about Siddiq Barmak's Osama. It's a dark film about a girl living with her mother under Taliban rule, and it won a Golden Globe in 2004. The real market for films like Osama, however, is in the West. Actual Afghans have long been far more interested in the action and drama of Bollywood movies for a wide range of sociological reasons. Mohammed Salimi, a media expert who does freelance work making movies, remembers growing up on them.
I grew up in the 80s and 90s. It was full of, you know, the whole market was full of Bollywood movies, and still it is. The very first Afghan movie made, it was a co-production, a collaboration between Afghanistan and India. And that movie started, you know, that movie industry or movie business, filmmaking art, started in Afghanistan in a collaboration with India, and it was a black and white. It's not a love story.
The shared culture between Indians and Afghans accounts for much of the popularity of Indian movies. Ahmed Shakib Dost, an anchor for Radio Television of Afghanistan, comments.
They are portraying the image of a family or a society or a community that they have some link with the Afghan culture. We cannot say that these dramas are imaging or reflecting 100% Afghani culture, but 75% of Afghani culture you can find in Indian dramas. That's why people are just attracted by these movies.
The affinity for Indian culture and Bollywood movies is so great that it actually has had a stifling effect on Afghan cinema. Dust again.
Afghan filmmakers are complaining always that this Indian filmmakers dominated the market in Afghanistan. And no one is watching Afghan movies. If you see, 20% of the whole population, you can say that they are watching Afghani movies. But 80% of the population in different provinces of Afghanistan, they are watching Indian movies. And as well as, if you go to the shops, the stores, you can find thousands of Indian films, Indian movies, and the rate is also low and people can buy it.
According to Salimi, most of these films are pirated versions imported from Pakistan or China and then sold by local vendors. He says that because of the now 9-year-old war against Taliban insurgents, little attention is paid to this issue.
No, I mean, nobody can stop them. Anybody can go and buy a bunch of them and bring it to the country and sell it.
Though the government seems not to be concerned with copyright issues, the movies are screened for content. Salimi says that movies and music videos on television are also carefully policed.
Any Bollywood song screened there, a movie, if there's any hugging, caressing, or kissing, it's taken out. If a cleavage is seen, it's taken out. If the girl has a miniskirt and you can see her legs, it should be taken out, censored. If not, then the TV gets fined. And it's not just the government. I mean, the government or the Ministry of Culture and Information showing reaction. Parliament shows a strong reaction. Supreme Court is another one sitting there. And Parliament is full of very conservative religious people.
Salimi thinks censorship is distracting, and that limited education and censorship combined limit the influence of high-quality film on Afghanistan. He sees the current state of Afghan film production as coming in two distinct streams.
There are two streams of filmmaking in Afghanistan. One is completely like Bollywood. There's a guy, there's a girl, they're in love, or there's a good guy, a bad guy, there's drug dealing, there's fight, there's song in the movie. And it's made by some Afghans there that they have been in Pakistan. They have spent a little bit of time in Pakistan with a very low knowledge of filmmaking. So it's the same kind of structure, movie making. They don't have necessary and proper equipment to make movie and make it in Bollywood level. So it's really low quality in everything.
Afghan film that is more refined or cerebral or addresses social issues often fails to reach the Afghan masses.
There's another one which is a very high quality Afghan cinema that's kind of like has given a identity to Afghan cinema in West, especially in Europe, and that is movies made for festivals and dealing with the political and social issues.
Movies like this, which include the minimalist Osama and Earth and Ashes, are produced by filmmakers educated in Europe or Iran and are financed by foreigners. Some small-scale movies by one-man production studios have distribution potential if they can get some exposure at European film festivals. There's not much of a market for those movies in Afghanistan, though, so it's no surprise that the government provides no support. Salimi goes further, saying that these socially conscious movies are beyond the understanding of the average Afghan.
Well, let's say in Earth and Ashes, there is a scene. It's a little bit surreal, abstract scene. A grandpa with his grandson is traveling, trying to go and find his son who's working in a coal mine. And the village has been bombed. When he gets there, he gets informed that the village is bombed and everybody's dead. So he loses his entire family. And there's a scene that his daughter-in-law, which is wife of his husband, runs naked while the village is burning out in the background. She's running like a wild horse in with some slow-mo shots. It's culturally not accepted there. And it's also intellectually, people can't get what the director is meaning with that, you know, what he wants to say, what's the point here. So it's a little bit beyond the understanding of an average person there.
Part of the young generation includes filmmakers who make documentaries and short movies that are more straightforward, but still socially aware. A typical Bollywood movie, on the other hand, is not only much easier to follow, but provides an escape from reality, rather than a reminder.
They don't want to watch those movies because those movies are pretty similar to their daily lives, what goes in their daily lives, and they don't want to watch it. They want to watch something different from daily lives, and those are the movies made similar to Bollywood movies.
Dust says that language is also a significant factor in the popularity of Indian movies.
Now, most people, most young generation, they only know Urdu. They can know what is going in an Indian movie, but they don't know what's going in Hollywood movie because they don't know English. But within 15 years, within 10 years, the people will get more educated. The people will learn the other languages, mostly English, and they will go for the Hollywood too.
As for the few professional Afghan filmmakers, they may have to do business abroad for some time to come. For War News Radio with Ramya Gopal, I'm Karim Sari Ahmed.
This is War News Radio. YouTube has produced many minor celebrities and internet phenomena because it provides a stage and an audience for anyone with anything interesting to say. Soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan have been taking full advantage of this, posting videos of their experiences in the conflict. Kyle Crawford has more about soldiers who use YouTube to tell their story. This piece first aired in July.
That's how I do it on the dismounted patrols on y'all, man. That shit real quick.
Dunson Vision.
That's what I like to call this, Dunson Vision.
Thank you for tuning in.
Entering the search terms Iraq or Afghanistan and war into YouTube yields about 800,000 videos, and many of these were shot by soldiers. During World War II, radio and newspaper reports were the primary way the public was informed about the war. During Vietnam, the major television networks delivered images of the battles waged in Southeast Asia. But now, the power to deliver war footage is in the hands of soldiers for the first time. Philip Hindmarsh, who served in Afghanistan for the British, sees YouTube videos posted by soldiers as a way to fill the gaps in the media's coverage of the war.
Obviously, the news only tell a general picture of Afghanistan as a whole, and they don't go down to the soldiers' level, if you like. They're sort of more looking at the command element and not looking at what each individual soldier is experiencing.
Hindmarsh posted a series of slideshows that are a mix of videos and photos with music that he says capture the essence of his deployment.
For example, for a period of 3 months, we were held in a base location and getting attacked up to 9 times a day. And some of these attacks were lasting 2 and 3 hours. We weren't making a difference out there. We were just defending for 3 weeks. And that was what I was showing in my videos is it's the actual ground truth. You see the firefights going on and it's just showing an account of basically what happens every day.
For many, sharing videos on YouTube is a way to connect with family and friends.
And certainly when my father seen the videos, he was proud, basically. He didn't understand what was going on fully, but he was proud once he'd seen the videos.
Plenty of the YouTube videos posted by soldiers are slideshows like Hindmarsh's. But there are also numerous videos that are purely raw combat footage, depicting firefights or soldiers on patrol. Sergeant Leo Dunstan, an American, has posted a number of videos from his deployment.
Oh!
No other war really. Were they able to videotape and actually have on footage them shooting or, you know, killing other people or even, you know, at war in a firefight? You know, that's unheard of. There's nothing like that ever in the history of war in general, you know? To have live footage or something like that is something that's priceless, really.
But Dunstan added shooting video is not without risk. And he recounted how he filmed the firefight that is posted on his YouTube page.
Yeah, but yeah, there is danger of it. You know, the guy that was with me, Specialist Susky, he came up and, you know, he had the video camera. He's like, let me tape you while you're shooting out of the window. I didn't have my, you know, my flak vest on or nothing. So, you know, if he had got shot, you know, why, you know, we'd have been screwed, you know. And while we're sitting up here trying to videotape, then I'm, you know, how am I going to show higher when they see the camera just dropping and him getting shot, you know. At the same time, you're thinking, how cool is this going to look if everybody gets to see it, or how cool can, you know, is this going to be when I get to look back on it?
The raw soldier's point of view in many videos like Dunstan's are not only important for the public, but as Hindmarsh explains, they can be a resource for those considering the military, or for soldiers about to be deployed.
I would have loved guys to have an insight into Afghanistan and such before one, they joined the army, or even deploying out to Afghanistan, so therefore that you can identify the weaknesses and that those that don't like the idea of it don't deploy. So therefore, when you go to Afghanistan, you know you've got 90% of the guys within you that actually want to be there and want to fight, and they're not going to become liabilities. So yeah, it definitely gives an insight.
However, he thinks that sometimes the ability for anyone to share videos of the war can go too far.
There is some videos what go on there which I kind of disagree with. There's a couple that have been on there in the past, which I'm not sure if they've been taken off now, but it was with private security companies as well, was people actually being killed. You didn't see the death, but you heard on a couple of videos, you heard, you know, the casualty and pain and then dying. I think that's a bad thing, simply for the fact of relatives and family and stuff. If they see that video, it's not going to be very welcoming to them.
But Dunstan thinks that even graphic videos should be shared with the world.
I've seen videos like that too. Honestly, my personal opinion, I think that there shouldn't really be a hold on it. I don't think that it really is really going too far. I think that people deserve to know what's actually going on.
While there are a great deal of videos that depict firefights and combat, there are many that show other aspects of life. Eric Anderson, a public affairs officer with the 3rd Infantry Division in Iraq, produces YouTube videos for their division's official YouTube page. Anderson describes the subject of the division's videos.
These aren't out on combat patrols. These are the guys that make sure that everything runs smoothly over here, that we're safe, that we're getting our food, that we're, you know, working with our Iraqi partners. All these little jobs that sometimes go unsung.
The channel also highlights the lighter side of life. One video features a spoof of Fox NFL Sunday, where NCOs face off against field grade officers in a flag football match.
Prediction, we win by 3 touchdowns. You can take that to the bank.
Is that the officers is just going to totally run over the NCOs.
The soldiers I spoke with saw the ability to show this side of life as one of the strengths of YouTube.
I got the one video on there of us playing MTV Punk. When we're over there, we're doing all kind of, you know, jokes here and there, having fun. We also mingle with the local people. I put on there with me dancing with some of the local Iraqis and stuff like that. I didn't want to make it, you know, people think that we were just over there, you know, we hated all of them.
YouTube allows soldiers to share their experience in war faster and easier than ever before. No longer do the major networks or military command control the dissemination of the images of war. For War News Radio, I'm Kyle Crawford. This is War News Radio. It's easy to talk about war in terms of numbers, casualties, years of conflict, or money spent. But art expresses what numbers cannot. My co-host Amandine Lee went to the Windows and Mirrors exhibit in Philadelphia and spoke to artists and visitors. This piece first aired in November.
Had you walked into the Art Street Meeting House in Philadelphia in October, you wouldn't have found just a Quaker religious center, but painting upon painting hanging from the walls. The traveling exhibit, called Windows and Mirrors, consists of 45 4x6-foot brightly colored mural panels. Most are painted with thick black lines outlining motifs of warfare, suffering, and violence. 3 marionettes with pained expressions, the outline of a body on the ground missing a leg and an arm, an Afghan girl caught in the crosshairs of a rifle. A few have softer themes, of a kite flying above the Afghan countryside, or a butterfly emerging from the word salam, meaning peace in Arabic. Then there are drawings created and captioned by high school students in Kabul, showing what life is like for them during wartime. One shows a pigeon shot by crossfire. Another is of a young amputee with the text, "A boy's body is information about the war." Charles Kelly, a real estate salesman who came to see the exhibit, found the children's pictures among the most poignant.
I see the children calling out, "Help, help," in their, actually the little words attached to some of their drawings. And my feeling is, in front of this one, that I get some of the agony of a person hit by one of the United States bombs. And it's so easy to forget that that people are dying agonizing deaths with our tax money. Like, you know, it makes me partially responsible, I think.
The war in Afghanistan entered its 10th year in October, but was hardly mentioned in the recent U.S. midterm elections. The American Friends Service Committee, or AFSC, conceived of Windows and Mirrors to bring awareness to, and, if possible, urge for the end of the war. The exhibit travels around the country, spending a month in each location. Karen Light, artist, teacher, and AFSC staff member, describes how the concept came about.
This came from the Chicago office, where we were talking about how to create something, and we wanted it to be artwork because we feel like it has a capacity to really touch people emotionally. And we wanted to come up with something that it wasn't so overwhelming that people felt like they couldn't act, like they got gripped by that, but also touching enough that people felt compelled to do something.
AFSC sent out a call to artists, and their prompt was simple: respond to civilian casualties in Afghanistan. The entries they received were numerous and varied.
We feel like we've gotten the range of emotion that anybody feels about war as a result. We've got suffering, we've got the pain, we've got the terror, you know, but we've also got the courage, we've got the information, we've got hope.
The artists themselves had a variety of motivations for participating in the show. Contributor Ann Northrup was motivated by the art form itself.
I've been working on these murals for 10 years, and the whole idea of a mural is, you know, a big public artwork has so much power beyond what I can wield in my little studio, you know, and my own little mind. And I just love the idea of a real public message that needs to be told. And so this project, with its theme of ending the war in Afghanistan, and with the backing of the American Friends Service Committee national organization, has the power to really magnify my message.
Artist Deborah Gross-Zuckerman had a personal connection.
I was excited by this proposal because several years ago, our son Alex joined the Marines, and I had been doing many pieces against the war since then. It was hard for Philip and I to understand how our son, who had been taken to peace marches all his life, and son of two artists, could ever join the Marines. But it was something that he had to do, and as a result, it was something that I had to do by being creative in my artwork to express my feelings.
Joe Bredman, another contributor, was inspired by his desire to connect to the war.
That's something that is missing, you know, from many of our experiences. Very few Americans, I think, really know and have any real connection to that war, and yet we're paying for it. And it's us that are supporting it.
Ultimately, the American Friends Service Committee is a pacifist Quaker organization, as Karen Light explains.
We also hope that people will just be compelled to pay more attention, to call their senators, to call their congresspeople, to bring up what they've learned to their family and friends. It could be as simple as that. But as somebody earlier mentioned, you know, it was really sad that in this election season, the war was hardly mentioned. And so we need it to be there. We need it to be something that people are talking about.
After Philadelphia, Windows and Mirrors moves on to New York, then Santa Monica and Chicago. For War News Radio, I'm Amandine Lee. This is War News Radio. The recent Senate focus on the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy has spurred heated debate. In this piece, first aired in October, Min Chuen Nguyen and my co-host, Sam Hirschman, talked with soldiers affected by the policy and their supporters. Here's Chuen.
Most Americans oppose Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So do Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. President Obama said ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a priority in his State of the Union address.
This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are.
But last month, Republicans blocked a Senate bill that would have ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Opponents see their window for congressional repeal slipping away and say that the costs of the policy are far too great for the military and for the American people. Jonathan Hopkins, a graduate of West Point and a former captain in the U.S. Army, was discharged in August 2010 because he's gay. When confronted, Hopkins wouldn't lie.
I was not about to, like, try and fake that I wasn't gay in order to stay in the military. Like, to me, the cost was kind of too high. And the cost had been very, very high already. I just kind of hadn't realized that yet.
Hopkins is just one of about 14,000 U.S. service men and women who have been kicked out of the armed forces because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Most are good soldiers. Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't related to job performance. David Hall, a former Air Force staff sergeant discharged for being gay in 2002, thought he was pretty good.
I was well respected at work for what I did and was promoted many times, you know, received many awards.
But that didn't matter when another cadet turned him in to their commanding officer.
That pretty much ended my Air Force career.
Opponents say that driving out good soldiers is a main flaw of the policy. Sue Fulton is the communications director for Knights Out, an organization of West Point graduates that supports the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
This policy is damaging our military. Our whole point about Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't about equal rights. It's about strengthening the military. Don't Ask, Don't Tell weakens our military every day by kicking out good soldiers or by weakening good soldiers by keeping them, they're not allowed to talk about their lives with their comrade. It's crazy and it's bad for our Army.
Supporters of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, on the other hand, say the armed forces will be hurt by repealing the policy. Fulton says evidence from NATO allies, most of whom allow gay service members to serve openly, doesn't show that.
Everything that we've learned from our NATO allies, all of whom have openly gay service members, except for Turkey doesn't, but all of our other NATO allies have openly gay service members. Everything that we've learned from them is that allowing open service was a non-event. There just were not any issues.
Since Congress rejected the repeal, opponents of Don't Ask, Don't Tell have been trying to decide what to do next. Diane Mazur, a law professor at the University of Florida and an expert on the military and Constitution, says the issue will fall to the courts by default.
It isn't really because courts are trying to seize control of this. It's that everyone has taken this issue, Congress and the president, and by their own inaction, I think they've dumped it in the court's lap. The court is the last adult left in the room.
And the courts are responding. The Log Cabin Republicans is an organization committed to getting equal rights for gay and lesbian Americans by working within the Republican Party. The group recently won a decision in the California District Court that struck down the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy as unconstitutional. But Christian Burle, the deputy executive director of Log Cabin Republicans, describes a long road ahead.
We have been given every indication that the president will appeal our ruling to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then we feel confident that our argument would prevail if it comes to the Supreme Court.
Because the process in the courts could take years, activists are still looking to Congress for repeal. Hall, who now works for Service Members Legal Defense Network, an organization committed to repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, has his sights set on December.
Our push will be to make sure, one, that a vote happens during the lame duck session, and two, that we have the 60 votes to move the bill. And that's not just pushing Congress, but at the same time, pushing the administration to help with that, calling up senators, especially on the Republican side, so that we have a bipartisan vote.
If Hall is right and Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed, he hopes to be in uniform again.
I definitely would want to go back in, when we do get Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed.
If gay service members are allowed to serve openly, the issue may just disappear. Jonathan Hopkins thinks someday people won't understand the controversy at all.
I think the best parallel to this is desegregation. You all know the decision by President Harry Truman to overturn that was the right decision. You all know it.
Whether progress comes through Congress, the White House, or the courts, opponents already envision the military without Don't Ask, Don't Tell. For War News Radio, I'm Xuan Nguyen.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Lewis Katz. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Sam Hirschman.
And I'm Amandine Lee. Until next time, thanks for listening.